Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
People who, like the founder of the show, recognize they're on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person, share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength, capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders, deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is part sinner, part saint, on Late Night Poets After Midnight Blog Talk Radio. We are a group on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are, because you can read with us and comment with us and talk to us in the chat. It's always a party. I'm Afaziana, and with me I have Babbler. Hello, Babbler.
Hello. Hello, hello. Happy Friday. How's it going?
It's been a sleepy Friday, quite the lazy one, to be honest. Yesterday was busy, tomorrow will be busy. Today was my kind of, like, reprieve, the hideaway from the world. How are you?
I'm okay. I've been having some pretty nasty anxiety the last couple days, but just took, like, a nice warm bath, and so hopefully I'm good.
Yes, hopefully that will help.
Crawl up on my desk time. So, yeah. I'm okay at the moment, but it's been a pretty rough couple of days.
Well, I read a poem that you wrote about it, or about anxiety in general, and I loved your poem. So as much as I hate that you have anxiety, I do love what you do with it, how you help others with it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, sometimes it's just better to get it on paper while I can. I don't know. It's to just get it out. I don't know. A little bit. Can't really cry. I struggle with that. It's a good outlet for me.
That's good. I'm glad that you have it. I like it too as an outlet, but not always as coherent. Like you sound so like eloquent and put together for someone who's having anxiety, and I'm just like scared now, fear, bed. It doesn't always come out. So,
Yeah, I usually feel beautiful. Like I'm gonna vomit. So, like I just kind of very nauseous, and I kind of check out. So. Yeah, I can still talk, but, like, I'll stare a lot. I don't look like someone who's having an anxiety attack most of the time.
Yeah, sometimes I can hide it, sometimes I really can't. I'll be, like, in the middle of a meeting, and I'm, like, convinced that the plane that I hear is about to bomb us for no reason. I'm not in a dangerous spot. And just be, like, totally focused on that instead of what I'm supposed to be doing. And, like, my whole body feels cold and sweaty and just, like, yeah, the nausea is definitely a thing. And people are like, are you feeling sick? No, just...
Yeah.
But yes.
But no. I wish I could, like, attribute it to something specific. You know, when people say that, like, this plane or this thing. For me, it's like something bad is going to happen. Any minute now, something bad. But it never decides what. Like, there's never, like, a thing I can focus on. It's always like, well, you fucked something up, and somebody's going to call you on it. And you don't know what it is, but any minute now. And, like, I don't, there's no, and I just live in that for a while.
It's just, like, the cortisone running through you. Cortisone's not the right word. Adrenaline. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have attributed it to the boss music in a video game, where it's like, you don't see the boss yet, but you hear the danger music, and it's like, something's going to happen that is bad, but I don't know what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The battle music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, why is everything so high strung? I'm just walking through this field.
Yes.
It is. But it's like living like that in reality. So every hair on your body is like, where's the guy with the knife? So.
I feel ya.
Yeah.
Our show tonight has three prompts. We have the quote, you're beautiful because you know your own darkness, and still that doesn't stop you from finding your light. And then we have, I don't know who said that one. The second one, she was devoted to the moon in its darkness. She found comfort, and its light she found hope. And that one is by the Wild Woman Sisterhood, found on PaganGrinder.com. PaganGrimoire.com. Not Grinder. Grimoire. I was like, Grinder. When was I on Grinder? But no, Grimoire.com.
Interesting websites you're checking out.
Right? Pagan Grinder? I'm really curious if that is a thing.
Is that a market?
They get a big upswing in people looking at them tonight. It's going to be ours. we did that. They're like, how do people know we exist? Oh, well, Aphasiana made a mistake, but we'll go with it. And then our third prompt is the color indigo, which was your contest. All right. Let's jump. I think we're going to have some really great poems. I really do. I'm going to jump into the first prompt, and our first poet is Julie Buck. Brilliantly blended. Windows to your past, much darkness still wanders. The 19th century mansion on a hill, not in want of anything except to haunt the time it thrived. Dead now, but very much needing human touch, which promotes a shine deep within. Decrepit domicile made of wood, the blackness bellows, as it will, because this old house, atop a hill, in shadows, but never forgotten, hears the memories, feels the emotions when fallen off course, spirits attempting to be seen, wanting to be a flesh again, not quite weaned from the secular world. Windows to your past. Much light still ponders. The beauty you portray is because you've brilliantly blended your night with your day. End poem.
Great read, Ephesiana. And I love that this poem did not take the direction I would have expected. You know, you'd expect it to be about a personal story or, you know, something about understanding your own shortcomings or overcoming something. And that's a great direction to go. But the fact that it's about a house in the darkness and the light of a house, you know, an old house that's seen a lot, that has walls that talk, you know, has stories to tell, I think is really fascinating. You know, I haven't lived in a house quite that old. There's not a lot of houses around here that old. I mean, Washington State became a state in 1898, so there's not a whole lot of 19th century homes around these parts. But, you know, the houses that I have lived in, you know, I've lived in some 1900s homes. I've lived in some 1920s houses. And you always wonder, like, how many people have lived here and what kind of things have happened in these homes, and have they been happy families? Have they been, you know, terrible families? You know, what was it like? You know, I thought that especially when I bought my 1928 Craftsman home and I was remodeling and I was taking off the layers of wallpaper, or like six layers of wallpaper that went back all the way to the 20s. And, you know, I'm just like, I wonder what each person was like that put up each one of these pieces of wallpaper. You know, but the darkness and the light of that, especially like the decrepit domicile, you know, once a place that was, you know, habitated, now kind of left to rot almost, unless it's taken up again and restored. But I love that, the feeling, the emotions, like the personification of this home and the things that it's seen, the fact that it's still standing. I love that. To brilliantly blend your night with your day, with the good and the bad, the dark and the light, the passing of time. I thought it was a beautiful poem. Oh, well done, Julie. Your thoughts, Faziana?
I liked that it was about a house, too, and it gives that sense that a place usually has both good times and bad. And while some places have had, you know, more trauma than others, perhaps, and some places are generally somewhere where people are happy, there's something about an old home that has a mix of things. It has these marks, like you said, the layers of wallpaper, the potentially like carvings in the wood. It talks about it's made of wood. If there's a hole in the wall where something happened, there's scars to a house, and you can see that it needs caretaking. It needs a human touch. So not only does it need to be, you know, cleaned up, it's not like we need a robot like Wally to go clean the garbage off of it. We need it to have that that loving care of adding things to it and helping things grow, it needs a person to revive it. I like that. My favorite line was, not quite weaned from the secular world. The idea of, like, not being weaned from the living world, these ghosts who are not ready to move on yet, they're still having those little sips of life and wanting to know what's going on and remembering having a body and having that connection just a little bit more where they're not ready to grow up into their next stage of passing on. I really liked the wording of that, not quite weaned. Now, I've never thought of the living world as the secular world exactly, because I think of the secular world as the not religious, thinking secular being like the difference between church and state. So maybe the secular world is like, it's not like heaven or hell, it's not that religious area. Or maybe secular has more sides to it than I know. But I definitely liked the not quite weaned part of that phrase.
Yeah, you know, I like what you were saying, like, basically about how a house needs, you know, like, life, you know, breathed back into it, which, you know, can't really be done by, like, just a coat of paint. You know, that'll also feel sterile. You know, it's interesting, too, I looked at the time frame of this, you know, being a 19th century home, and that made me think of the, you know, not only the fact that those homes don't really exist here, but they definitely exist on the East Coast of the United States. It made me think of, you know, when I went to Ireland and I stayed in a row house that was, like, really old. I want to say 16th century. And it was so funny because I'm not very tall. I'm not super short either. I'm 5'3" and a half. And in this house, everything was like perfectly my height. And that's not true of homes where I live. I always have to reach or get a step stool to reach like upper cabinets, to reach all kinds of things. But in this old Irish home, everything was perfectly my height. And it just made me think of, like, you know, that change over time. Like, how many stories did those homes have to tell? So I really enjoyed the write, though. Well done.
It is interesting how that changed, and people are generally taller now. And I'm curious if that's evolutionary or if it's because of, you know, mixing of genetics from different areas. And some places had taller people, and now that it's more amalgamated, that's not a good word for it, but,
homogenous.
You know, homogenous with many cultures within most people, or at least in North America, we tend to be multicultural background because immigrants from all over. I wonder if that has influenced it or if it's just like everyone was shorter then. We were less nourished. We didn't live as long.
Huge part of it is nutrition. Nutrition's huge. Like, even if you look at North Korea versus South Korea, you know, the average height of South Koreans has jumped up about 8 inches in the last 50 years just due to nutrition.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a huge piece of it is nutrition, getting good food. You know, being fed, especially during years where you're growing, is a huge difference in height. I mean, genetics obviously plays a role. You know, no matter if you overfeed your kids, they're not going to be 6'8". Like, that's not. It's kind of like genetics puts in the bar, you know, for low versus high, and nutrition helps determine where on that bar you fall. Like, there is a.
No, you're like me. You start growing the other direction.
They'll keep growing, but it won't be a height thing.
I like to blame my height on that. You know, being about 5'2", there's not a whole lot of room to grow upwards, so it had to, you know, go wider. That's just part of it. All right. Our next poem is by Scraps and Scribbles. You go for that one, Babbler.
All right. This is Critical by Scraps and Scribbles. So, I've been living with this fella. He lives inside my bones. He feels he is a fortune teller. Won't leave me alone. I'm a well-accomplished slob. Don't need no sound advice. This fella, though he's quite a knob, berates me every vice. My scruffy clothes still keep me warm. My scruffy life is good. And yet he feels my will's deformed. He tells me what I should, or rather should not do or be. He tucks and judges I. He's like a soggy biscuit tea or a finger in the eye. I can't evict him, make him better. Can't even make him quiet. Instead, I write this kind of letter to settle my disquiet. I'm just a boy rolled out of bed and into this thing life, and I'm just a track by Radiohead with my pocket knife. No, I don't need no ideal eye, no super ego neither. If all he does is chide and chide, I fly and he all spider. I want my soul to be a cloud for easy on the flow easy on the breeze. When dark, some thunder be allowed without a by your leave. To be a mess with no duress, no begging on my knees, where I decide what's more or less, not perfect, just at ease. No squatter in my head deriding, please. End poem.
That was a wonderful read. I love that you, like, picked up on the accent, I think, because to make teller rhyme with fella, tella, you did that really well. I love the way that this captures that kind of internal voice. He lives inside my bones. My scruffy clothes still keep me warm. My scruffy life is good. Sometimes you like your scruffiness. Sometimes it's, you know, you don't want to get out of those sweatpants and tame your wild hair. Sometimes it feels like the right thing to do, but there's that voice of, like, you know, get up and do things. And I think they both have their place. You know, the get up and do things is good most of the time. But you gotta let yourself be a little scruffy for once in a while. Perhaps I do a little too much. I really liked the, like, a soggy biscuit tea. Or a finger in the eye. Like, that's such a nice way of saying, like, it sucks. He judges I. It's like a finger in the eye. You don't want a finger in the eye. It's just not appealing to anyone. I enjoy the my wits, my pocket knife as well. That had a very Tyrion Lannister kind of vibe, which I enjoy. This is a really enjoyable piece. It has a wittiness to it. You know, it's deep, but it also has sort of a fun way of saying everything. So there's a personality to it that I quite enjoy. Scraps and Scribbles is being scrappy. I like it. What do you think, Babbler?
I liked this piece. I thought it had a really great, strong comedic voice to it that was really brought out by that bouncy rhyme. You know, but I love how even in this piece, it gets a little bit critical. You know, first of all, you're criticizing your own criticism, which is a little bit redundant, but I appreciate it. And then second is, like, you're calling yourself scruffy. You call yourself at your wit's end, you know, and a bit of a bum, really, which is, you know, critical in its own way, you know, but, like, hey, I don't want to be judged even by myself. And yet, I guess we all need a good finger in the eye every once in a while, you know, from ourselves, with a little bit of self-motivation. But too much is too much. You know, you don't want to constantly be criticizing and, you know, deriding yourself, which isn't good. You know, but a well-accomplished slob, you know, You know, I agree with you. I did really like the line, you know, he's a soggy biscuit tea, which is not any good. You know, your cookie is just completely falling apart in there. It's not very tasty. Or a finger in the eye, you know, which is just really kind of like an annoyance. You know, those aren't serious problems. Like, it's not like he's an axe murderer or, you know, something crazy. It's, you know, a minor inconvenience, you know, something that's annoying. You know, it's like, you know, an annoying little brother, not, you know, a major problem, just a little bit aggravating, which I liked. You know, I wish I could leave myself alone for a little bit, just stop harassing myself. So I liked it. It was fun. It was comedic. It was light. And yet it had a really good message to it, you know, just the carefree versus critical sides of a personality. So I thought it was a great write.
I agree. Our next poem is Go to Sleep with the Sunflowers by Ben Hart. We drove your mom's little green van to the edge of our domain, where the gold washed into gray, a world devoid of man, where the earth bruised after beating from the rain, where one could let go a little at the end of the road. There is nothing more standing in your way. You said you had your doubts about you and me, and the death of Van Gogh. Looking at the clouds, I poured you a cup of steaming tea, but sadly, it was only mango. You painted the heavens by whatever design made sense to your stubborn eyes. I paid the devil with whatever's mine to squander, to survive. You may have been there by my side, but you were the furthest thing from here. Locked in a stare at the heavenly tides, us mortals were taught to fear. You said death is the only angel we'll ever meet. And I've never meant to reply, honestly. Then I am sorry you're so blind. I am right here, and you're looking for another. You suddenly heard my heart cease to beat and saw the clouds fall far behind. As I asked you again, against the coming quiet, Would God even bother? Extend a hand to a brother, fallen out of orbit, out of heart's reach, forever adrift in the mistless, in the beautiful breach. Golden hands racing for the moon, to be the first to break her barren bosom, yet unblemished by hungry men, intent on stealing her glow. They're coming. They'll be there soon. And Luna, my love, if you ever want to lose them, I think you should go. Follow me and my horrible dreams of a worthy end to humanity, and not the one I wished upon me, the one I said I wouldn't wish upon my enemy. But now I guess I did, it seems. Was loving you worth my sanity? Is this even love or just my vanity? We set fire to the car when the tea ran low, and it was getting dark. I played guitar when it started to snow, and you played your favorite part. Something free, outside the city of boundary streets, running with wolves in circles around the fire, for me to see, watch as it fleets, into another memory for the mire. Vincent, oh Vincent, I sang, why the rush? Why did you go to sleep with the sunflowers? When there were so many waving fields of churches made holy beneath meteor showers that hadn't yet sprung from your brush. When you were done dancing, but the darkness still lingered, and the wolves had their way, you finally saw me as I saw you, breaking away like sand through split fingers, pushing stars to fall when they were meant to stay, waiting for the devil to want what he's due. We are here. Here we are. The falling of a tear doesn't leave a scar. The man in the mirror doesn't believe in the dark. To see it clearer, you need the contrast. Watch it pull the moment apart. Always a shadow is cast. All you have to ask is how far. Still, I think it best we don't tell your mom what happened to her little green car. End poem.
Really enjoyed this write. You know, just about that struggle, you know, between being happy and being sad, and how often they are so tied together. You know, how the good memories and the bad memories can often be related, you know, especially when it's something like a loss of a relationship or a death. You know, when you've loved someone and you have all these great and wonderful memories and you feel that really deeply, it feels that much deeper for the loss, you know, for when it's gone and for that pain. You know, and when you felt really pained and you felt really low, when you feel happy, it feels that much happier. You know, it's interesting how things work in extremes like that. You know, I love how it starts with a really personal moment. You know, we drove your mom's little green van to the edge of our domain where the gold washed into gray, a world devoid of man. You know, just going on a little bit of a road trip, just getting away. You know, it's some escaping, and it feels like a really good memory, you know, like a good moment. You know, but then this talk of, you know, things separating, things not working out, you know, quite probably suicide, based on phrasing and references. You know, the first reference here to Van Gogh being, you know, you said you had your doubts about you and me and the death of Van Gogh. Looking at the clouds, I poured you a cup of steaming tea, but sadly, it was only mango. You know, not feeling good about the relationship and not even sure, you know, about the way Van Gogh died, which, of course, you know, suicide. You know, and this whole talking about how this relationship isn't strong enough and doesn't work out, and how happiness and sadness are so tied. It's really a beautiful piece that kind of interweaves all of these scenarios, you know, wanting what you can't have and wanting to protect something even when you're the worst thing for it. You know, golden hands racing for the moon to be the first to break her barren bosom, yet unblemished by hungry men intent on stealing her glow. And yet as this goes, you know, it's like, and what am I more or less than a hungry man, you know? So, you know, I'm trying to protect you, and yet I am the thing I'm trying to protect you from, is a really beautiful thought, you know. And then again to Vincent, oh, Vincent, I sang, why the rush? Why did you go to sleep with the sunflowers when there were so many more waving fields and churches made holy beneath meteor showers that hadn't yet sprung from your brush? You know, all that lost potential, all the additional artworks that could have been, all of the self-expression that could have happened but didn't. Due to death, and then to tie back in again, you know, to this relationship. You know, we don't tell your mom what happened to her little green car. You know, and it's how, you know, they basically drove off a cliff in it. It's kind of like, you know, the ending of things and the darkness and the brightness and how they work together. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a beautiful, really, really well-layered write about a pretty, you know, sensitive topic, you know, about that struggle and the failure of it, you know. I really liked it. I thought it was really well done, Ben. I'm having trouble pulling all the lines that I liked because there's so many little layered ideas in here. You know, the idea that you need the contrast. Always a shadow is cast. All you have to ask is how far, you know, there's always a downside, you know, but can you make it out? And the answer to that is yes, because the only time you can't make it out is when you decide not to. So I really enjoyed this writing. I thought it was really well done. What did you think of Faziana?
I loved it. And I mean, I think you really captured the key points in your comment. The part about the lost potential when they're talking to Vincent is striking because it makes you think about it for all the different kinds of potential that the other person in the poem has lost too. But the idea that there could have been waving fields and churches and meteor showers, and there was so much more that could have been painted, and worrying about the light that may be lost when if you choose the more shadowy side. And it's just, it's really a sad piece, but it's done so beautifully. Even the way it describes the planet, where the earth bruised after beating from the rain, like to call it bruised, and the idea of, humans ruining the way that it was marked. But imagine before that happened, a world devoid of man. At first, when it was doing that part, I was thinking about, like, the moon, and for some reason imagining that, like, the craters on the moon were related to our visits to it, which is not, because it's meteors, and the idea that it was, like, smooth, and it's like, let's just end while it's still smooth. My mind goes in strange places, but I really loved the artistic feel of this, and the way that it questions, is this even love, or is it my vanity? Was loving you worth my sanity? Why did you go? There's questions in it that let us pause and think about the conflict, the internal conflict, the things that we wonder about with people that we've lost. There's just a chance to contemplate things. I really like the way the questions were used. It wasn't an overwhelming amount of questions, so it tells us things, not only asking them, but there's just enough that it makes you think even more. I thought this was very well done.
Agreed. I do think the use of questions in here was well done. You know, they were, you know, mostly rhetorical, you know, like the evaluation. I also thought about the irony at the end, you know, we don't tell your mom what happened to her little green car. Like, who's going to be spilling those beans? So, anyway, it was a wonderful ride. What do we
actually
have
interesting here? Because right before the show, I was listening to some old school Eminem, and Stan, the song about the fan, when he's driving off the bridge and he goes, "Oh no, how am I going to send this in?" And he realizes that, like, you know, he's been narrating his suicide, and he wanted Eminem to receive that, but he forgot that he's not going to be alive to do that. So he panics as he's about to go over the bridge. How am I going to send it in? I thought of that moment as at the ending there when it says that, you know, don't tell your mom. And it made me think about that, where you can't.
Yeah,
it was just the timing of it.
Not gonna get this.
After. Yes.
I it's funny that exact song. I rewrote the lyrics to a few years ago, because I was talking to someone about the redefinition of the term stan. Stan is slang now for being a really big fan of something, and it's considered a good thing to be like a stan, you know, means like a loyal, like unwavering fan. But it's weird to have like lived through the time where those lyrics, you know, the stan came from, that Eminem song, but that is not the kind of fan that anyone should want to be. Like,
no.
Celebrities don't want stans, and you don't need to be a stan. Like, they're delusional. They're, like, way too into the celebrity. They have this fantasy relationship that doesn't exist. Like, it is not good. And so I just found the irony in that. So I rewrote the lyrics to stan as the modern definition of stan. Like, if you were to receive fan mail from what is now considered a stan and not a crazy person who kills himself. So anyway, that was just a fun experiment that I did a while ago, but it just reminded me of that.
I want to read that. I didn't even know that Stan was, like, considered to be a good one. Like, I didn't know the new slang. I am out of touch. But you definitely don't want to be Stan in that song, in that video. I mean, he kills his pregnant girlfriend.
Millennials are going to tell you that you don't want to be a Stan. Gen Z is going to call themselves a Stan proudly. It is a completely different meaning. It's usually used as, like, a noun, you know, like, oh, yeah, I'm a Stan, or I Stan that, you know, I Stan, curly, you know, usually how I read it, but I always find that kind of funny, because I'm like, you don't want to be a Stan.
No.
Not a good thing.
You do not want to
be
a Stan.
Do you need help?
Does your basement look like Stan's? Do you copy, like actually glue pictures of Eminem on your wife's face? Like,
you think they know you exist. If the answer is no, calm down. But that's not how it's meant anymore. You know, it now means like a loyal, like unwavering mega fan. So if you read someone calling themselves a stan, they're not saying they're mentally unstable.
They're not saying it, but it could be. anyway, I've got us off on a tangent. Why don't you read the poem by I can't say the name. I'm just going to let you go for it.
This is A River's Light by Garonwy. That's how I'd say it. Could be totally wrong. Don't know. This is how it goes. Found in a west moon rising, a fantasy of light. In an Escher painting black, birds turning white. Flowing in the river's face of hope for tomorrow. Left in the darkness of your light. Touching Fatima's hand, knocking on the door, protecting from the blackness that offers evil thought, offering sanctuary in pages made of light to write away the darkest demons, who dance in nightmare's night, letting you find light, breathing in the sunrise of opening the eyes, escaping from your dreams, guided by the hand, finding light in the river's flow. End poem.
Well, I really like the use of the reference of Escher here because his paintings definitely have that duality sometimes that we're talking about here. When he's referring to the painting Blackbirds Turning White, I remember that painting, and there's actually a couple ones like that, but where it's, if you look in the white space between the birds, it's the shape of, I think, a fish. But there's, if you look at the black between the fish, you see the birds. If you flip it upside down, it's a totally different image. It's all about perspective. And perspective is what we're talking about in this quote. You know your own darkness, and still it doesn't stop you from finding the light. There is the darkness there, but if you're focusing on the darkness or if you're focusing on the light, you see a different side of it. I think just by referencing Escher's painting, so much gets across there. Now, where I lose it, and it's because of my own ignorance, I'm not sure about the Fatima reference because I'm not familiar, but I think that this whole thing is a really interesting view of things, and the river's flow being connected to the light just works really beautifully. So, well done. What did you think, Babbler?
I love this as well. I also loved the reference to Escher, you know, thinking of his tessellations that are done exactly like that, the morphing, especially like the birds that turn white or black, or the fish turn into fish, or there's so many, and the shapes fit together so perfectly as they morph is beautiful, you know, that fading. When I read Fatima, I pretty sure that's like a Catholic reference, a title that was given. I'm not sure. I don't know much about her, but I know that that is a Catholic lady, the Lady Fatima. But basically, I think it's like being woken up by a saint, being protected by a saint, offering sanctuary in pages, I think is a reference to like reading the Bible, finding hope and faith in religion, and then to wake up again, to have nightmares at night, but then to find joy in the day. It's okay to have bad dreams, and to be happy in the daylight. I like that, that cross reference, the seeing from darkness in several different ways. So, I enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done. It was a beautiful piece. I loved that opening with the Esther, reference. But I do think it's a semi-religious piece, but it's a very pleasant and serene write. So I enjoyed it very much. Well done.
I think I might have to do an Escher contest at one point. I quite enjoy him. I looked up Fatima. Same. Fatima seems to be quite complicated, but the gist of it, of what I'm seeing, is the Virgin Mary appeared in a vision for some shepherds near the village of Fatima in Portugal in 1917, and it's all connected to that and what she said to them. So being guided by her, you're right, it's related to Catholic, I was going to say lore, that's not quite right, but, yes, you were on the right track.
I'm pretty sure I've heard it in reference to Catholicism, but I'm not that well versed in, figures or, in Catholicism, having not been brought up Catholic, don't know that
and
many. I've heard it, I've read it, but
the weird thing is that I did 12 years of Catholic school and I don't know, but
I don't know. I read a lot, but you should read a lot too, so I don't know.
I do. I think we were very much New Testament, and that seems like it would be... No, because 1917, that wouldn't be Old Testament. I don't know. But I'm just going to stop talking before I incriminate myself further in that. this one is by Daniel Deschino, and it's called Shadowland. Wilderness of mirrors, a shield of rusted eyes. I dance between the shadows and hide from holy fire. Light is blinding and darkness blinds, but there is truth somewhere in Shadowland. The realm between darkness and light, refraction, symphony, color, chaos. Light is the capella vision, cowering sheep in a field of cotton. Treasure in a dead man's hand. Darkness is death, an innocence inch away. I stand on the edge of a cliff. Fear of falling is vision, and ignorance is a blink. Close my eyes and I feel the calming wind. Open them and I believe in gravity. Torn apart by perception, mauled by thoughts, coerced by experience. There are colors beyond the rainbow. There are sounds beyond vibration. A kiss on my cheek is a million miles from an atomic explosion. In the realm between darkness and light, in the shadowland, when I see snowflakes breathe as melting fog, when I dance to the blood pulsation of the highways, when the wilderness of mirrors is clear-cut to reveal an empty cosmos, I will know there is no darkness and there is no light. End poem.
I thought this was a really interesting take, kind of defying it a bit, putting it in nothing is all good or all bad. It's all shades of gray. And the way that it kind of dances back and forth between the two, you know, both light and dark are blinding. You know, you can't see either. If you're surrounded in complete light, you can't see anything. It's just whiteness. And if you're surrounded in complete darkness, you can't see anything either. You know, both are blinding. And I love that he points that out here, you know, but in Shadowland, in that in-between is where you actually see everything. The refraction symphony, color chaos, light is an acapella vision. You know, just all of the in-between. You know, that's where all the color is. That's where all the refraction is. That's where, you know, what you can see is in between the two. I did like cowering sheep in a field of cotton because that would be really hard to see. You know, you have white fluffy sheep in a white fluffy field. Like, that could actually be really good camouflage. But you have something really cute and light and fluffy and happy cowering in fear. You know, the juxtaposition there, I think, is really well done. You know, treasure in a dead man's hand. You know, again, it's something good and something bad. You know, and there's all of these things all the time. I also really loved... close my eyes and I feel the calming wind. Open them and I believe in gravity. You know, if you limit what you expose yourself to, you know, you can just feel certain sensations, you know, to feel calm, you know, to just close yourself off a little bit. And then when you open your eyes, everything kind of feels more grave. You know, everything feels heavier, torn apart by perception. So I enjoyed that too, just, you know, sometimes separating yourself a little bit from the world can be really relaxing. You know, there are colors beyond the rainbow. There are sounds beyond vibration. That's true. You know, we're limited by spectrums that we can see and hear. You know, those are only, there are limitations to what we can experience. And it's wild, too, because there are so many animals even on this same planet that can experience such a different range of things. You know, the hearing of whales is so much lower to the point where we can't even hear a lot of whale calls. We have to pitch them up to be able to hear them, you know, or like rabbits and dogs, you know, can have such a higher sense of pitch that we can't hear that either. A weird tangent, you know, one of there's a Tool album where they did the music in a range broader than human hearing, and sometimes pets will react to it. And I think it's really cool that they thought to include the scope of their in the scope of their songs, sounds that can't even be heard by people. I thought that was a really fascinating thing too. You know, but just the idea that we live in this middle land. You know, we've never really experienced true dark or true light because it blinds us at a certain point, and we're kind of trapped in this small spectrum of existence. And I really enjoyed that as a thought very much. You know, I see snowflakes breathe as melting fog. You know, just the enjoying where you are, even though it's temporary. You know, just been experiencing what you can experience. I really enjoyed this write. I thought it was a fascinating take and very well thought out. So I enjoyed it. What did you think?
Well, when you were talking about music and how some that one band, what band was it? Who did the sound outside of the range? I already forgot.
Tool.
Tool, okay. My brother did for his science project 1 year. He had a fish, or actually he had several fish, and he would change the music and monitor how they swam to see if they would respond to different kinds of music, like we would dancing, like go faster or slower or whatever. And I'm wondering if he ever used Tool, and that would be so cool. Mind you, I don't know if fish would be along that spectrum, but anyway, tangent.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the whole poem, but I like that you pointed out the part about the sheep being, like, a cute cuddly thing that looks cute in the cotton, but it's cowering. So there's negativity even within the cuteness. And then the next line, treasure in the dead man's hand, there's good even within the bad. That contrast there starts us off like pretty intensely. And then the fear of falling being vision, the idea of not knowing, being making you less afraid. If you can't see that it's a huge drop from this ledge, then you don't know to be afraid. You don't think about it. I was watching this show, See, with Jason Momoa, where everyone in the world basically is blind, except for his kids, who have a special ability to see, like we do. And the people are walking, like, along these, like, ropes and stuff, and they're really good at it, so they're doing okay. But, like, watching them not realize that they are, like, above, like, this giant canyon is just terrifying to a person who can watch. And not being able to see it, they don't think about that fall to the same extent. They might know that they could fall, but not how far and what it's like when things do fall. So that part about opening your eyes, I mean, that it, yes, sometimes not having a sense activated changes the way that you feel about things too. I liked the contrast between a kiss on my cheek and the atomic explosion, like saying there's such a big range of how things feel. So not only are there sounds that are beyond what I can experience and colors beyond what I can experience, the things that I can experience are so varied that to talk about the difference between the light and the dark is almost unimaginable. Because there's such a vast space in between the two extremes. It's really intense poem that gets you thinking. It's very thought-provoking. Well done, Daniel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how it's both limited and broad. Even in that, you have the juxtaposition, you know, there's so much to experience, and yet it's so limited. You know, how much are we missing, and yet how much can we take in at the same time? Some really good thoughts in this. It's got some, like, Descartes leanings for me in terms of thought and, you know, perception. You know, like, is our entire world just what we perceive, or is there more out there? So, enjoyed it a lot.
Very cool. Babbler, I'm going to get you to read the next one, and it is A Hunter.
Darkness, A Hunter by Ikael.
All mankind are children of the dark. If ever light breaks through, darkness overcomes it, and it's the sin that we choose. I hate to see a person sin against me, yet this happens almost constantly. It's in the transition, isn't it, when men flip the script and seek light in friendship. Darkness is a jealous foe, a force unknown, a deeply sown stronghold in our soul opposed to ever letting go. So we look at the light and we see it, all right, but we are of the dark, and in the light we see that it is sin indeed that is within our heart, and we deem righteousness merely as an annoying counterpart. We choose dark at the closing, while the light is never the option truly chosen. Yet, if you open a door to the light, the enemy will know that you can see the cross in his eye, and in this transition, you will be persecuted both day and night. Are you ready for this new life, a life of poverty and hatred, ostracized and demoralized, cut off, ridiculed, and dehumanized? Now, if you are in the light, you will see the prince of dark things and observe an immutable shame, And you will see, you will clearly see that this devil has become the fallen one who orchestrates the blame game. Satan has a huge family on earth, so be strong and ready. They are all coming to get you. End poem.
Ominous at the end there. Very eerie, dark poem, but has a lot of personality. It's cool. The format is very interesting because it's narrow. Like, there are line breaks, but they're not in the places where I would anticipate the pause. So interesting choices. The darkness is a jealous foe, a force unknown, a deeply sown stronghold. I like that, especially deeply sown stronghold, that it's right within the fabric of who we are. I really like that, deeply sown stronghold. There was another part here. To ostracized and demoralized, dehumanized. There's internal rhymes here, and they're all really strong words. Just a lot to think about here. You know, quite a dark ending, but some interesting thoughts. You read it beautifully, Babbler. What did you think?
I think this is a really darkly religious piece. Like, it's almost threatening. Not almost, it is threatening. You know, Satan is coming to get you is more or less how this piece ends, you know. It feels almost puritanical in its reading. You know, the you can't choose lightness, essentially, because human beings are flawed. You know, we are of the dark, and in the light we see that it is sin indeed that is within our heart. So, like, there's no way to not be a sinner. You are intrinsically not good. You know, but you can open a door to the light, which I assume, you know, is religious, since most of this seems to be pretty deeply religious. You know, but if you do that, then people will see that you are religious and you will be ostracized and persecuted for your religion, which sounds very puritanical to me. You know, and some part of me wonders, you know, like this perceived persecution, this perceived ostracization and demoralization, you know, how much of that is looking at everyone else and saying you're evil, you know, and getting laughed back for that. It's hard to say. But I don't think by necessarily being Christian, you're going to be ostracized, demoralized, ridiculed, and dehumanized. You know, I know plenty of religious people who that is not their life. You know, and that if you are in the light, you will see the prince of dark things and observe an immutable shame. And you will clearly see that this devil has become the fallen one who orchestrates the blame game. You know, like, you'll see, so if you're in the light, if you've accepted this religion, then you'll see the darkness in everything around you just feels, like, oppressive. You know, it feels like that'd be really hard to do that, to look at everybody and see the evil in them all the time, and to just see everyone around you as evil. That seems really dehumanizing itself. Very isolating. You know, this is a really darkly religious poem, and it reminds me a lot of Puritanism and, you know, the essays, like, you know, about the angry God. God, what was that guy's name? I believe, gosh, I can't remember the name of the essayist. Very famous essayist during, you know, early American history and colonialism. You know, who basically wrote that you know, there's evil everywhere, and even God is angry. You know, and it also reminds me of like the Scarlet Letter era. Like, it's darkly religious, but it's well done. but it feels very oppressive. Not that that's a bad thing. So, fascinating, right?
It's basically that puritanicalness that made me leave religion, but it was well written. So, you know, to each their own style. We are on to the next prompt. She was devoted to the moon in its darkness. She found comfort, and in its light, she found hope. So we're going to start with one by our list. Where the world will drown again. Between shadows and the moon trees bend, then bow towards the court of giants. They rule the world like swift-mounted tyrants, charging down hillsides, setting fire to vacant towns. I wander the forest and wedge between towering oaks. Their canopy covers me against the heat of torches. Light carries within it the dark underbelly of night. I trade my orange-blue garments for flowing black robes. Behind the cool curtain of darkness, I practice my lines. For this tragic comedy, I have washed my hands of blood. I make my bed in yellow leaves scattered across the forest floor. They insulate me against cold and coming storms. In the tenuous morning light, I will rise to a vantage point not given to mortal men. I will carve this poem in the bark of oaks. They shall carry my name past the desert to the sea, where the world will bow and drown again. End poem.
Really interesting. You know, when I read, between shadows and the moon trees bend, then bow toward the court of giants. They rule the world like swift-mounted tyrants, charging down hillsides, setting fire to vacant towns. I picture old-growth forests, you know, with this court of giants. I originally think of, like, the redwood forest, but then those wouldn't really lend themselves to forest fires because redwoods are just naturally resistant to forest fires, which is pretty cool. But, you know, that's what I think of is, like, old-growth. And you know, to wander through the woods, you know, and to be covered against the heat of torches. So, like, bringing the fire into the woods after you talk about how the fire goes from the forest down into the vacant towns, I'm almost, like, going, is this arson? Like, what are we doing with the torch in the woods? You know, and to switch out of orange-blue garments for flowing black robes. You know, to turn something dark. It almost, you know, is it some kind of religious garb almost, you know, it's hard to say. It just feels very, you know, ritualistic in some way, you know, to then behind the cool curtain of darkness, I practice my lines for the tragic comedy. I've washed my hands of blood, you know, some kind of like evil ritual in the woods is what it feels like. You know, something. Wash my hands of blood. You know, it's kind of dark. Wearing black robes with torch, washing hands of blood. And then to sleep in the forest almost feels like a protection. You know, in the tenuous morning light, I'll rise to a vantage point not given to mortal men. You know, so do you become a god or maybe you die? You know, it's so hard to say. You know, to carve a poem into the bark of oaks, you know, it's almost like a way to live longer. You know, so it's like saying, I was here. Excuse me. You know, it's so common to humanity to mark your place, to say, you know, I was here. This is a thing. This is a complete side note and outside of this poem. But when I read towering oaks, I'm always very curious about that line. There's so many things called towering oaks, and yet in my experience, oaks don't really tower. Like, they're not that tall of a tree, and they have really broad, wide canopies that it's not really a tree I think of as towering. But maybe that's just, you know, in my experience of living where I lived, you know, maybe in other places they are towering. But here it's like where I'm surrounded by redwoods and cedars and fir trees, it's the oak tree is kind of dwarfed. I mean, it's even kind of dwarfed by like the big leaf maple, you know. So I always find it interesting when I see things that are called towering oaks. Because I'm like, it's not really a tree I think of as towering. So anyway, but that's a complete aside. That's just my experience. Anyway, I enjoyed this poem, but it is kind of interestingly dark, you know, and ritualistic feeling. So well done, Arlis.
I really liked the line, light carries within it the dark underbelly of night, because light by its nature is going to cause shadows. You can't have those shadows without having light. So the dark underbelly of night is just such a cool way to talk about those shadows that follow when you have something like a torch. I liked the choice of the garment colors too, because I think this has some like shamanic, like pagan kind of feel to it. But it also could be Buddhist, because I'm pretty sure they have like really bright orange garments when they like monks. So if you go in as a peaceful monk, with the orange being like your lighter side, you're thinking like you're going to preserve all creatures, including like the bugs and things. And then you trade it for the flowing black robes of maybe something where they end up being, you know, not at all that Buddhist mentality of preserving life. Instead, maybe thinking of it as like sacrificing, which could be the hands of blood, something like maybe sacrificing an animal, maybe sacrificing yourself. If your thought on the maybe not mortal men is a death. Interesting that it had tragic comedy as one word, and also, I mean, it shares the sea of the tragic and the comedy. It's not just two words put together. It really is tragicomedy, sort of like dramedy, where it's put right together into being a word that means both. And you think about someone like Shakespeare, who has their tragedies and their comedies, but not necessarily is the comedy funny the whole way. There can be darkness. It's just it ends on the note of something like a marriage or having a baby. Like those were like the traditional comedy endings from a long time ago, where even if maybe the marriage was not a great thing, it's considered a comedy. Whereas if it's a death, then it's going to be the tragedy. But maybe this is a tragicomedy because the circumstances of the death are good to a certain degree, I guess, if that's what they're going for, or the circumstances of the what normally would be comedic is bad, and it's that combination of the dark and the light. Really interesting choices here, and the yellow leaves scattered across the floor, insulating you against the cold, does make me think that it's more of a death, like it's sort of like you're burying yourself in the forest. The carving of the poem onto the bark is giving yourself immortality. You know, people who wanted to live on wanted to be the subject of stories and songs, and that's how they would become immortalized, is people would hear about them. And so for the oak to carry the name past the desert to the sea, that's the idea of trying to live on beyond your corporeal form. Very interesting poem.
Yeah, tragicomedy, you know, is a literary genre. it's like it takes elements of a tragedy, like the Shakespearean tragedy and a comedy, and kind of blends them together. So it's like either like a tragedy that has enough jokes in it that overall people are laughing most of the time, even though dark stuff is happening, or is like a really serious poem that serious book or play that doesn't have a lot of jokes in it yet has a happy ending. Like it's really dark and twisted and yet the ending is happy, you know. For some reason, what comes to mind, even though I don't know why this has come to mind, this is what comes to mind, is like if Requiem for a Dream had a happy ending, like they all got clean at the end, you know, like, you know.
Yeah.
They don't. But
well, I mean, genres have definitely blended a lot. Like, when I'm looking at, say, on Netflix, I'm flipping through the recommendations, it will say comedy and have so many things under it that I would never consider to be comedy. I'm like, that's so sad, or that's scary. Or it will be drama, and then we'll have some, like, things that I would think are hilarious. And I'm like, how did, no. Who cataloged you?
Well, I would think it's funny when it's, like, Romeo and Juliet gets put as, like, you know, a romance, and I'm like, it's not really, like,
no,
not really.
Like,
I guess in many of the retellings it is, but like the original story is not very romantic. Like, there's, I guess, like, not really.
I know. It's seen as one of the most beautiful love stories, but there's no chemistry between the characters.
No,
like, you don't develop, like, they don't talk. There's no, like, really, like, physical excitement that goes on. And it's just, like, families feuding, people dying for, like, futile reasons, and just, like, they're too young, and it's just, it's wrong in so many levels. And I know that, like, as, like, an English major, people expect me to love it, and I'm just like, no.
No,
I don't.
It's like a 3-day relationship between two 8th graders just to piss off their parents. Like, it's not romantic. A lot of people die, including the main characters. I don't think that's a spoiler at this point. It's not romantic. It's, hey, I think you're hot at this party. Let's piss our parents off. Like,
yeah. And, like, he kind of already had a girlfriend. Like, I mean,
it's not good.
Like,
yeah. Anyway.
Anyway.
And in my
yeah.
mind, the most interesting character in that whole thing, you know, isn't even Romeo or Juliet. They're, like, the least interesting. Mercutio is definitely my favorite character. Or the nursemaid, who's just straight up a pervert. So.
Yeah. But in most Shakespearean plays, I like the minor characters better. I usually like the servants. I usually do.
Yeah. Yeah. Mercutio, I can't say his name today. Mercutio is, like, a smart mouth. And literally the nursemaid, who is, like, Juliet's nanny, is a total perv. So she's my favorite character in the whole thing. But it's really not that good. It's not even, like, one of my favorite, like, Shakespearean plays. It's not that good. Anyway. And it's not a romance. It's not romantic.
The background of this next poem looks romantic. Look at the flowers. It's Waiting for Us by Joseph DiMaggio. Thank you.
My turn or yours? All right.
Yours.
Waiting for Us by Joseph DiMaggio. In this lonesome star sang a mother for her son. In the dark side of this moon, a father wept for his daughter. The siblings, the stars, with clasped hands together, prayed for them to reunite soon enough. Being wrapped together in blankets of diamond sheets, translucent pearls. The earth waited for the end, paused before the conclusion, and let the credits roll. There was only one gratitude given in eternity, It read, "Thank you, Father and Mother. The sun stood behind the moon revealing her light, and the moon carried the torch, radiating from then on. Love showed us that they were there all along, waiting for us. The ending is where our home is, and love is from when it first began." End poem.
Great read. I love the part where the sun provides the moon with that light, and the moon carries on the role of shining. The sun stood behind the moon, revealing her light, and the moon carried the torch, radiating from then on. And I think that's really beautiful because the sun is where the moon gets that light, and we can pass on our light to future generations. And then they, in turn, shine in a way that helps us experience light, too. This is just really a beautiful, thoughtful poem. What did you think, Babbler?
Oh, yeah, I thought it was very lovely and romantic, about love of parents. That like brought you into the world and the thankfulness for them, demonstrating love, a loving family, with sibling stars, and the moon and the sun. And I thought it was just very beautifully done. And to me, the ending here, waiting for us. The ending is where our home is, and love is from when it first began, meaning, things are cyclical, you too will die, and then you will go back to your parents and, like, be together again, it feels very cyclical, very reuniting, when I hear the sun stood behind the moon revealing her light, that's an eclipse. And I thought it was really interesting to be, like, revealing her light, to show the moon by backlighting it, to do an eclipse as a way to be, like, look at the moon. I thought it was interesting because it's true. It's probably, the time most people look at the moon. A full lunar eclipse, people want to go see it. but I thought this was beautifully done, showing, like, support in it. And it reads like a funeral. The funeral is really more about love and togetherness than it is actually about loss. So I really liked it. It was very romantic. There's sadness in there, but there's a lot of love as well. So I thought this was a nice write. Well done.
Great comment. Our next poem is by Stephen T. Wellman. And my computer's going super slow, but this is going to be called Resolve. Okay. Can you post it on the board, Babbler? Because I can still read it because I had it open, but it's not letting me do anything with it.
Sure. Let me go grab it.
Thank you.
Which one is it?
Resolve by Stephen T. Wellman.
There it is. My eyes just kept skipping right over.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay, I can't tell what you've done because I can't see. It's not refreshing, but that's all right. Resolve by Stephen T. Wellman. Is resolution really a solution? Do we only resolve to be better, to do better, once a year? Galaxies glimmer, we search the stars, yet so much light can be found in clay jars. So many changes needed in a world spinning on fumes. Haven't we hurt ourselves enough? We borrow love only to give it back. So many contradictions in messages we send. Don't settle for ordinary. You are extraordinary. if anything, find your voice. Make the choice to sing. Sing even if you can't carry a tune. The moon doesn't shine on its own. End poem.
I love the interestingness of this piece, because the resolve, is resolution really a solution? And do we resolve to be better, to do better once a year? I mean, for me, the answer is no. I don't really make New Year's resolutions, but that doesn't mean I don't resolve to do things periodically throughout the year and very often fail. But, you know, for every 100 failures or so, right, there should be one success, I hope. I also love the line, so much light can be found in clay jars, you know, hidden and locked away where you can't see it from the outside. You have to open the jar to find the light. And when I picture a clay jar, I don't know why, I usually picture like pigments or dyes, which I found is a really fascinating image here. I also really like the line, we borrow love only to give it back. And the reason I love this line is because, of course, if you borrow something, you're going to give it back, right? Otherwise, you either stole it or took it or asked for it. But if you borrowed it, you're supposed to give it back. So I just thought that was funny. But I did love it as a line, especially to be followed up with so many contradictions. And yet that in itself was a contradiction, to say that, we borrow love only to give it back. Like, that's the point of borrowing. Make a choice to sing even if you can't carry a tune. The moon doesn't shine on its own. Sing for your own joy. You know, there doesn't need to be more, you don't have to be constantly trying to please people. Like, you can do things for yourself because you want to. And more often, those are the things that are going to be successful anyway. You don't have to wait for New Year's. If you want to sing, sing. If you want to do something and you're not any good at it, that's okay. Be crappy at it. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to be good at things to enjoy them. I like to kayak. I am terrible at kayaking. I'm horrible. Like, I'm so bad. I go around in circles and circles and can't ever get myself straight for some reason. Very frustrating. But I do it anyway because I have a good time out there. I like the feeling of being out there. I just enjoy it. So I do it anyway, even though I'm terrible. I'm not entering any races. I'm not trying to win a contest. I'm not looking for anyone's approval. I'm having a good time. And that in itself is enough reason to do something. So I really enjoyed this piece. I thought it was wonderfully inspirational with little tidbits of humor tossed in. So great job, Stephen. Your thoughts,
Stacey? I was thinking about the clay jars, and in Mesopotamia, or like kind of ancient, I think it's like Middle East, down into Africa, I'm thinking of like old school, so before there were such borders, clay pots were used in a lot of stories. I'm thinking of like the Epic of Gilgamesh, although I can't remember the details of it. And so I did a quick search because I was thinking about that and thinking that it meant something. And in Sanskrit, a clay pot is often taken as meaning the body. So it was referred to when talking about the womb or the earth or a woman. And so the pot that he's talking about might be people, that you can find light within people, within those jars that maybe you don't realize there's going to be light, but if you take the time to look inside, then there is. And then it also came up that in the Bible, our lives are described as pots of clay. So I think, again, from multiple sources, the clay could be us. It could be the people in your lives. And there is light that is within the people here on Earth. So we look to the stars for answers, but maybe you have it within yourself, that light already. So I don't know if that's actually what he meant, but I like it if he did. And I like the idea that the moon doesn't shine on its own. It needs the sun. So it's okay if you're not great at something. You can still enjoy it and find inspiration and bounce off the light of those around you as well. You know, I'm not a great singer or a musician, but I work with some musicians on this website, and sometimes I'll write something and they will turn it into music, and then that's, you know, we bounce off each other's strengths, and maybe the light has to reflect off of the moon, and we can be the moon or we can be the sun, but we can work together to spread the light.
What you were saying about clay jars and, you know, how the Mesopotamians viewed themselves, like, as people of the clay, you know, it really made me think of, you know, other cultures and how almost every culture kind of views them as a people of the something that is relevant to the area, you know, corn or, oh, gosh, I know a whole bunch, and now they're all escaping my mind. But it's usually, like, food or earth-related. But I love that idea of that, as of, like, the clay pot being the other people, you know, being in humanity. And thinking about, like, other ways that that could be used or substituted. It kind of makes me want to do a contest about, you know, the different people of the insert cultural reference here. Because there's so many different ones that I always found fascinating.
I like that because, you know, people interpret the world based on their own experiences. So if clay is what they had in that area, then that's, you know, what they're going to make things out of. If corn, like you said, is what's all over the place there, then they're going to make connections to that, as corn is life-bringing. Corn is what feeds us. So whatever it is that's near you, you're going to make that connection to that being an almost holy thing that has made things matter. And people develop their cultures based on their experiences. So I think that's really cool. Oh. We are now on to your contest, Indigo.
Yay.
Do you have anything you want to say about it?
Yes, yeah, so this contest is the sixth in my Rainbow series of poem contests that basically is following the colors of the rainbow. We were on to the color indigo, so I asked for pieces that were inspired by that color. Like, what do you envision when you think of the color indigo? What comes to mind? So, as I do with many of my contests, I usually post some pieces of inspiration, things to kind of get ideas flowing. And some of those are quotes. People are welcome to use them or not use them, however they want it. So I'll just go ahead and give the quotes a read so that if anyone used or chose those prompts, we will understand the context of those pieces. So the first quote was, "Flaws were intimate, telling, pure. Indigo was pretty, like a wasted sunset, beautiful in a taken-for-granted sort of way." By L.J. Stern. And then the next quote was, "During the darkest indigo midnight, yet will countless stars blossom," by Dr. Sunwolf. Next quote was, "Hold on to your divine blush, your innate rosy magic, brown. Once you're brown, you'll find out you're blue as indigo, and you know what that means, indigo, indigoing, indigone," by Tom Robbins. Next quote was, "She watched the indigo sky and the stars coming out tranquil as ever, as if this weren't any ordinary evening. Only humans know knew what an evil time this was, by Joan Swanzowski. And the next and last quote is, "The sight of an indigo sky was beautiful. It was when darkness allowed light to shine for a while," by Namisha Toshnawal. So those were the quote prompts. There were other prompts, too, related to the color blue. That was the theme.
Excellent. All right. The first poem is by Ben Hart, and it's called Blue Dirt. Blue Dirt Boy by Ben Hart. I should have just let go, take up space in places I wasn't meant to stay. Not just sleep to make room in my cluttered veins for something else numbing. Why did you seize your loving whispers in my ear when you knew I needed the thrumming? When I needed to hear, the end is near, the end is near, we are almost at the end. My dear, I promise it's not long now until the morning comes around. Now the rain chisels at stains left by the blue dirt, as if they were the bruises in which this body poorly hid my hurt. Tattooed fingers searching in parting pairs for trepid trembling of barbed wire snares. As if they were but thorns on the rose I meant for the hand of the one that loves me not. Tell me what to play, and I'll gladly pay with borrowed blood. Something sad, something I'm afraid to sing, something adamant on lingering, like carmine eyes mourning one of those days where luck was not dependent on a cancerous clover, but the strength of our patience in the war against pain. Defeat is coming. Defeat is coming. The dream is over. It will devour every semicolon we place behind going to hills of wheat once golden and pastures painted red with papavir at indigo hour, but not their broken beholder falling out of love. The introvert who couldn't pick a moment worth living in, running through fields of morphine before the chlorine flood strips me clean of my unholy tendencies. I turn to God to ease my breathing, and what a bleak baptism it has been. I'm dying now, and I was dying then. And it's killing me you won't be there to scream with me when I need to scream, or else the silence wins. To tell me everything is going to be okay, even if I tell you I'm dying 1,000 times again. If not, love, will you hurt with me for as long as we can? Show me what a feeling is. Scream at me with all you have. I am not afraid. I am not afraid. Tue moi. Tue moi. Kill me. Kill me. Quand tu voudrais, when you want. Tue moi. Kill me. I am not afraid. Let the introvert be devoured at indigo hour. Someone who knew a moment worth living in. Let him die. The last before the dim, the depths he has fallen. No one ever came as close again. You may think you can claim the hope that wasn't meant for you, but I'll tell you when the revolution is, because at dawn's calling of a claret crusade against the blue, you will see the pugilist count to 10 before surrendering a fight that was his to win. Because death is a coward. And instead of panchromatic self, she will always send a friend. Death will walk the poet by the hand of their first muse to their next appearance. Past the sons of apostles I had left dead in the dirt, in the morphine fields by chlorine shores, their dreams distilled in poppy's tears. Past the golden hills where I had buried someone I adored and then stayed for 7 years. Why did it have to be someone I was so glad to have back, that I took comfort in them whispering, here we are here, at the end. You may be dead, but see that, Blue Dirt Boy? All of you that's left, all of you they'll never dare forget. This was Indigo Hour. Want to do it again? and pull.
This is a really interesting piece. Fascinating, right, Ben? Just about struggling to live, dealing with all those things that you want, and looking death kind of in the face, I thought it was really interesting. There are so many different lines in here that I particularly enjoyed. Why did you cease your loving whispers in my ear when you knew I needed the thrumming, needing that support, needing to hear that it's going to be okay, that it's almost over, but to lose that support, lose that person, to not have it anymore, the struggle of that, to feel alone when you were struggling before and now you're really struggling. I really liked the line, like carmine eyes mourning one of those days, red bloodshot eyes, where luck was not dependent on a cancerous clover, clovers supposing to have three leaves unless there's a growth anomaly such as cancer to give them four leaves, but the strength of our patience in the war against pain, those rough days, those days where it's all about just strength and waiting it out. And no, cancer clover is going to help you. It's those hard days. I love the idea of looking at luck as a cancerous clover. Is that really a good thing? The darkness behind the line, it will devour every semicolon we placed behind going to hills of wheat once golden. Semicolon being the symbol for, having been suicidal and lived through it, to devour that, to end the semicolon, it's especially dark. So many of these different phrases in here, just about losing support and suffering through. There was a line in here, dying, that I really liked too. I'm trying to find it, but it was, I was dying then and I'm dying now. And that just made me think, oh, here it is. I'm dying now and I was dying then. And it made me think of, sometimes I mess with my mom. I was a bit of a dark humor kid. I'm still a dark humor adult, but I mess with my mom a lot. I remember once her telling me, are you okay? I had gone to the doctor and I said, well, I have good news and bad news. I'm like, the bad news is that I'm dying. And the good news is I've got about 70 more years to live. Everybody's dying, but the rate at which I'm dying is pretty good. I'm dying at about 1 second per second against my lifespan, so that's pretty good. But it just made me think of, my kind of bleak sense of humor that I had with my mom. There was quite a few times I did stuff like that to her. One time she was tucking me in at night, and I said, Mom, don't ever leave me. Keep in mind my dad died. So this is why this is dark humor. Mom, don't ever leave me. And she's like, I won't leave you. And then she got up to leave the room, and I'm like, you're leaving me. I was kind of a terrible kid. Very dark humored. But this piece, just waiting to join the other person in death and trying to find, the will to live despite missing someone and not having your support system, and then I liked the end too. All of you, this was Indigo Hour. Want to do it again? Let's go through all the pain together again, all the ups and downs of life. Let's give it another roll, reincarnation, I thought was a really kind of interesting and darkly hopeful ending to this piece. There's a lot I could talk about, Nafisa. I enjoyed this very much. Very well done, Ben. Takes me a lot of places. Apisiana, what did you think?
I loved it. I felt really emotional reading this piece. It's strong. It brings to life the pain of dying and of, I don't mean the actual moment of death. I mean So leading up to it, the illness, the fear, the loss, and the needing reassurance, that constant need for some kind of comfort, and even if you don't really believe it, just having someone whisper something in your ear. I really like that question. When I need, like, why did you cease your loving whisper in my ear when you knew I needed the throbbing? And it's like, even after they lost the person, if that person died, which I later came to believe, even though at first I thought maybe the person just left them, then it's like there was a brief time when they were so out of it, maybe in like a fever dream, that it seemed like that person was whispering to them about how the next life was going to be okay. And then when you get clear-headed enough that you don't believe it, then you're mad at that kind of hallucination version of the person not being there. I remember my grandmother being like that when she was in the nursing home, and she always went through these phases where she thought, my grandpa was coming to get her, and he had been dead for, what, like 15 years? Really long time. And like at least a decade. And every once in a while, when she was not feeling well, she would put on her shoes and pack her suitcase, and she'd say, Grandpa said he'd be here tonight. And then we'd be really freaked out because it seemed like his ghost was coming to get her. And then she'd be, like, really mad when he didn't come. And she'd be like, well, I'm not going to believe him anymore. And then she'd just move on like nothing happened. But every once in a while she'd do that. And this just makes me think of that, like, why would you whisper that and then stop whispering? Like, if you're going to take me, then really take me. Then when it talks about the body not being able to hide the hurt, that is like something that I relate to really bad, because sometimes I'm chronically ill and I'm disabled, so sometimes I can hide it and just pretend like I'm normal, and sometimes I can't. And then I get really frustrated with my body for not being able to you know, play the game of looking totally normal. My hands right now are super, well, actually just one, is super swollen in like these weird red lumps. And there's no real explanation other than my body just doesn't work. So, but it's like usually it hurts or it's numb, but no one can tell. And when they can, I'm like, this stupid body. So if they were bruises in which the body poorly hid my hurt, I like that. There's something here about the introvert who couldn't pick a moment worth living in. That part really struck me. And the part that you pointed out with the semicolon, where the semicolon has been such a symbol of hope for people that life is not over, that it can continue after this. And then in this poem, the semicolon gets destroyed and there is no second act. There is no hope of continuing. That semicolon is gone. That was like a punch in the gut. That was a really strong part here that I don't know if everyone would catch, but I think it's so well done. This was a powerful, powerful piece. It was long, but it captured me the whole time. I definitely want to read it again. Great job, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Really, really strong write. Enjoyed it very much. What do we have up next?
Now we have one by Daniel Deschino. So I know we had him earlier, too, but this is for your contest instead of mine. And I think it's your turn to read.
It is. This is To Reveal the Wisdom of Nyx by Daniel Deschino. The light of the world has brought to me wisdom. I have been split into prismatic radiance, and I am starting to see the harmony of the colors collective. The peaceful happiness of the winter blue sky has brought me out into a sunlight world. and I wait the answer of what it wants. And indigo brings the radiant vision. Indigo, the missing link between night and day, darkness and light, the herald of Nick. Indigo, the overture to the symphony of the heavens. So much light does the darkness above cradle. I only needed to hear the call from indigo and look, and I feel the oneness of colors is near. End the poem.
Great read, Babbler. I love that he used Nyx, the Greek goddess of night, that shadow figure who personifies the night is just an excellent choice to use with this color. And to talk about it as the transition between the sun and the darkness, the radiance of it, and yet how it's so much light does the darkness above cradle. I like the wording there, and also that he makes it musical, the overture to the symphony of the heavens. I just think that he uses the most beautiful wording, and there's a lot of space in this, like a lot of white space where it's just short lines. Indigo is its own line, and not even just its own line, like there's blank lines before and after it, so it really stands out. Your eye is drawn to indigo. And it's as if you're seeing the color, even though it's just the word, it stands out the way that he has it all by itself and makes you think about the color for that extra second. What did you think, Babbler?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the spacing of this piece. You know, all of those spacings and all of the blank lines really give this a sense of, oh gosh, I can't think of the word, but where you stop and really pause on the moment and really think about it, because the lines are short and there are a lot of gaps. Just as a note, you know, Daniel has written to every one of my rainbow poem contests so far, and he's kind of tied them all together. So here at the beginning, too, he references blue. You know, the peaceful happiness of the winter blue sky has brought me out into a sunlight world. Now, it's a reference to like the past pieces, you know, and then to, you know, I wait the answer of what it wants. And of course, the next color is indigo. And when the sun goes down, you do get what's called the indigo hour. And when the sky is just that really, really deep blue. And it really does feel almost magical. It is literally my favorite time of the day. I love it so much. I've taken like 1,000 photos. Just trying to capture the magic of that feeling. And I think he does a really great job here of trying to get at kind of feeling, you know, where it's magical feeling. It's almost sacred. The missing link between night and day, darkness and light, the herald of Nyx, you know, indigo, the overture to the symphony of the heavens. And that's one of the things I've always really liked about that time of day, too, is it's like it feels like it's the time that stars are born. And you can't see them. And then as you get into that time when it's not quite dark out, like it's dark out, but it's not totally dark out, you start to see the twinkles. You know, you start to see those hints of starlight. You know, so much light does the darkness above cradle, you know, the edges of the sky being lighter. And I think that really makes that indigo feel deeper. You know, and then, of course, at the end, that last line, and I feel the oneness of colors is near. You know, the next color in the contest, obviously, being violet, to wrap up the end of the rainbow. So I thought this was a beautiful addition to his series that he's done, kind of following along with my contest. He just kind of holds that solemnity of that time of day that I also enjoy very much. I like the piece, Daniel. Thank you.
All right. We have 5 minutes left. I'm just going to look at the length of this next poem. I think we have time to do one more, and then we're going to have to carry some over to next week. So this one is Rhodopsin Rays by Blue Harrison. Little whirring watchet, you speak in clicks and chimes, your ancient shuddering arms still clinging to what's illiquid in nature, saturating the nainsook of framed sky, collapsing only after ironism has been achieved. But oh! When you crown, suffused face lift to Rhodopsin says, half a second till the fall. Still, you never forsake the chase. Vagation without gait, you seek heights so that they might focus upon your surge. That Pomerian minute when divine is glimpsed in you, a gallantry shadowed deepest blue. End poem.
The language in here is particularly interesting and acrobatic, in my opinion. Rhodopsin being the center in the back of your eye. Center is not the right word. I can't think of words all of a sudden. The receptor in the back of your eye that detects, like, those deep blues. You can't see it without rhodopsin. So calling it that, rhodopsin rays, I thought was a really interesting choice. You know, but throughout just the word usage, you know, illiquid, namesook, ironism, you know, there's this beautiful use of rare language in here, vagation, that, you know, is relating to like the muscle of the eye. You know, it almost feels like it's related to the ability to see in general, like having the sight. And then, you know, that Palmarian minute when divine is glimpsed in you, the gallantry shadowed deepest blue, you know, finding that light, that deep light within yourself as like a sense of divinity. I'm going to be short on my comments so that you can comment as well. But I thought it was a beautiful piece, Blue Harrison. Thank you. Your thoughts, Adriana.
We are no longer on the air, but I am going to comment anyway because it will be recorded. I found the vocabulary challenging, but I enjoy that. So I stumbled over it a bit, and I apologize for that, Blue Harrison. There were a few words that I didn't know the meaning to, and I like that because it makes me look them up afterwards. So you are helping my vocabulary, and I appreciate that. I think it was well done, and I'm going to have to dig into some new words, although Babbler did clarify the rhodopsin part for me. So thank you so much for writing. Thank you, Babbler, for your amazing comments all night. You are so great at talking about the poetry. Thank you to everyone who contributed to our contest and gave us permission to have your poems read on the show. Thank you to Fill My Eyes for giving us this time slot on your radio show. And we will see you next week, or talk to you next week, or not see you because it's not a video. And please check out both Aphasiana and Babbler on allpoetry.com to keep up with our contests. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you, Faziana.